Earthwatch with Robert Knight was brought to you live with portions on recording. This is WBAI, New York. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a late-night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a tribute to Theodore Sturgeon. Not the first, not the last, but a special one. Stay tuned. Well, it's a good thing that we practice or perfect or whatever the word is, freeform radio here, because things have been so confused that right up to this minute, I am not, you know, I don't have the agenda. I have the shape, not the exact content of the programming down this morning. Originally, Genevieve Valentine was going to be my guest this week. Her new novel is just out, and or just about to come out. But alas, she has had a death in the family and has had to leave town. We are rescheduling, possibly even for the pitching shift that will be mine next week from 1 to 3, I believe, if what I last saw is correct. Not sure about that. And possibly else in June. Got a lot of good guests already lined up for June and various agendas and stuff like that. But we will see how it all pans out. So next, I mean, this has been a crazy bunch of weeks for me. I have been so busy. Not necessarily with, well, things that pay the rent, but with, somewhat creative things, somewhat... Oh, I'm not going to go into it all. But I will go into one aspect of what is going to make me busy next Tuesday, and that will explain the agenda for tonight's show. Next Tuesday is the next meeting, edition, whatever you may wish to call it, a grouping of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings that I produce. And usually in November, we do a tribute. We didn't do one last year because of the availability of Noelle Sturgeon. Now, Noelle Sturgeon is the daughter, a daughter, but in this case, the daughter of Theodore Sturgeon, who is, well, simply one of my favorite writers ever of all time, period, bar none, etc., etc., etc. There are few people that can get that claim, but especially in that that quote, which I believe is properly attributed to David G. Hartwell, the golden age of science fiction is 13. Sturgeon really, really is a major part of that. Samuel R. Delaney, who I met when I was 13, actually I met Sturgeon at the same time, here at WBAI, are also a part of that. Well, meeting Noel Sturgeon at ReaderCon, as a matter of fact, we talked about the idea of doing that. She wasn't available in November, and so the big Theodore Sturgeon tribute was assembled to May 3rd. Then why is it that even at this moment I'm still putting it together? Well, things happen. But we have a fabulous agenda for next Tuesday, and I just wish it was so confirmed that I could tell you about it. Oh, I should leak it. I should say what it is. Two people, Nora Jemison, N.K. Jemison, who, by the way, was just nominated for the Hugo Award for Best Novel, and I told Robert on the second episode in this slot when I had her here. You remember her,
yes.
Young black woman?
Oh, beautiful.
And
yes.
I said,
brilliant.
I said she was going to be at least Hugo nominated, if not Hugo winning.
Yeah.
And the Hugo nominations were announced this past week.
Woo! Give me five. Yeah.
And I sent her an email saying, by the way, I am to be congratulated because I'm the one who made the prediction that she would be nominated. So everybody, thank me. She got nominated. At any rate. So she will be
you
one.
Did the hard part.
Yeah. 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 Exactly. I made the prediction. I know a good book when I see it. I know a good writer when I read her. Okay. So she is going to be one of the two readers. Don't go away, Robert, because I want to, like, you know, drop the little bomb. Okay, it's not official because I know that he has spoken to Noel Sturgeon, and I have only dealt with email, but he says that that he spoke to her. So my other reader will be Delaney something.
Samuel R.?
Oh, that would be the one, yeah.
Samuel R. Jim, you know.
So that'll be next Tuesday.
I'm grateful to you for.
Whoops.
But one of the things... Well, let's see. There are two books that were seminal in the distortion of my mentality that you recommended that I read. And one of them was Doris Lessing, Briefing for a Descent into Hell.
Yeah.
I later...
Which was actually Margot. I picked that up from her.
With the space fiction series Shikasta and all of that. But also the excruciating, tedious, gritty, dirty, hot, sweaty ordeal of Dahlgren.
Dahlgren is difficult.
Samuel R. Delaney.
Amazing book.
I loved
it. It is a book that will be studied in 100 years.
It was isometric reading. It made me stronger. I really am glad I did that. Thank you for
it took me three tries to get through Dahlgren. I could not get like past page 30 the first two times. And then it was difficult. It's not a simple book. It doesn't necessarily resonate.
The most difficult kind of prophecy is that is that which is most imminent.
Yes. And the third time that I tried to read it, wow. And this is like a 900-page book, I went right through it, and I went to the last, you can't say sentence because it's not a sentence.
Yes.
The last sentence is, for I have come, and then the first sentence of the book is, to wound the autumnal city. Mm-hmm. And it ends where it begins. And you know what? I just caught on right. that. And I went to I Have Come, and I went to wound the autumnal city, and I read it again.
Well, Jim, on that, I'm going to get out of here, let you do your show, and I'll leave you with only these two words. Nictitating membranes.
Oh, dear. Yes, absolutely. Some sad news relating to that Dahlgren and that as well. Something that I learned through, third hand through Chip Delaney. Two novels came out in 1973 that were among the seminal books of science fiction. One was Dahlgren, which, by the way, if people want to know, it's Dahlgren. And the other one is The Female Man by Joanna Russ. And apparently Joanna is ill. She's not just ill. She has been in a hospice and has reportedly suffered several strokes. She is a very important person to the literature. She was a very important person to me when Hour of the Wolf began, one of the first episodes that Margot Adler, who created the show, did, was on The Image of Women in Science Fiction, which was an interview on Hour of the Wolf with Joanna Russ that Margot conducted that I aided just a tiny bit on. And I'm afraid a few people are looking at, starting with Chip, are looking at her health with bated breath. So I ask everybody listening, whether it is on archive or live broadcast or whatever, to think very positive energy thoughts and send them out to the Pacific Northwest in the form of Joanna Russ and hope for the best. Okay, so next Tuesday at 138 Sullivan Street at Mission Free, a tribute to Theodore Sturgeon with confirmed Nora Jemison, a.k.a. N.K. Jemison. That's Jemisin. Read her novels. They're wonderful. And don't turn down any short stories by her that you come across en route. And purportedly, a Chip by the name of Delaney, Samuel R. Delaney. But hosted by, put together by, Noel Sturgeon. And this is, although we have two black writers and great black writers, not about black writers. This is about Theodore Sturgeon. Theodore Sturgeon, his work covers an amazing range. What he has done for the science fiction was, well, a lot of people might say he was the first one to turn it from a genre into a literature. In the 1940s, when he was writing for the pulps, he was one of the first to put in characters, to put characters first, in fact. But this does not mean that the story took a back seat. His stories were fabulous. His stories were amazing. And he wrote science fiction. He wrote fantasy. He wrote ghost stories. He wrote horror stories. He wrote westerns. He wrote television. He came up with a phrase called live long and prosper. If you don't know where that phrase was used, well, yeah, I think you probably know where live long and prosper comes from. Leonard Nimoy did the hand signal thing, but it was Ted Sturgeon who wrote the episodes Shore Leave and A Mock Time, which I call The 7 Year Itch, and In A Mock Time came up with that. Ted wrote a lot of television. And he wrote, by the way, for WBAI. He worked with Baird Searles in 1967 at about the same time that Chip Delaney worked for Baird Searles and was creating with Baird a number of readings, radio dramas, The Skills of Xanadu, A Touch of Strange, some wonderful pieces. And so to be able to do this particular tribute with Sturgeon's daughter, well, that's just thrilling. Okay, so again, well, I'll mention it again at the end of the show. It's 138 Sullivan Street at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. Free admission. Doors open at 6:30. Event begins about 7 o'clock. No matter who reads, what's going to happen, meet Noel Sturgeon and the rest and have a thrill, okay? Now, what do I have with me? I don't trust the tape recorder in here, and I am, although I brought a couple of reel-to-reels with me, but I'm not willing to put these master copies of reel-to-reel tapes on the machines here. I do, however, have some digital stuff with me. And I am in a debate with myself as to just what to play. And you know what? I'm going to leave it up to you. Okay, the one thing that I will not play this morning is Theodore Sturgeon reading Bianca's Hands, because that's one of the stories that will be covered on Tuesday. So that leaves me with, I'm not interested in the segment from the novel God Body. So that leaves me with a radio drama of one of my favorite all-time Sturgeon stories, A Saucer of Loneliness, which was done as a Twilight Zone, written by George R.R. Martin. To me, he's the guy who gave real quality to the Twilight Zone in the 1980s. To everybody else, he's, oh, you mean that guy in Game of Thrones? Well, yeah, it's the same guy, but you see, I liked George's actual TV writing and his science fiction writing more so than his fantasy, so sue me. What can I say? So we have an X-1 from, can it be as late as 1957? Max would know. Saucer of Loneliness, which is old style, but just this wonderful story. In fact, I got to read it at a Sturgeon tribute at this year's ReaderCon. Then we also have a almost one hour reading of Baby is Three, which is a fun, bizarre story. And that's Sturgeon himself reading it. And then we have a shorter piece, which would allow us more for time for calls. The Herkel is a happy beast. I see advantages and disadvantages to playing any one of these. So you know what? I'll take your advice. 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. It's not a democracy here. I'm not going to, take the most popular vote. But you can sway me. You can help me in my decision here as to what to do. And please note that when I give out that number, I will be putting you on the air. It's not just I'm going to pick up the phone and say, what do you think? Actually, maybe I should have done that. But right now, the way things are, and I'm not getting into conversation with people, tell me which of these choices you want and why, and we will make that decision. Bear in mind, the problem with playing Baby is Three is, well, Gee, that would leave us on. I can play the whole thing, but that would leave us no time for discussion afterward. The problem with the Hercule, there is no problem with the Hercules, a Happy Beast, or Saucer of Loneliness. Saucer of Loneliness is just an older production, and Hercules, a Happy Beast is almost too short, but you get to hear Ted's voice. Okay. Good morning. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi. Saucer.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Okay, next. Hi there, you're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to hear the Hercules Happy Beast because I've never heard it before.
Okay, very good.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And how about you? You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, Gloria Victoria.
I'm sorry, which one?
Gloria, this is Gloria Victoria.
Okay, which story?
Saucer. I'm very familiar with the other two, and this way we'll have enough time, everybody, to talk on the air, okay?
Very good.
Very good.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye. And hi there. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I think we should listen to Ted's voice. That would be sweet.
Okay.
This is George. Okay, but anyway, that's what I think.
Okay, so that would be Hercule or Long Ted or Short Ted?
Well,
1 hour or...
Oh, wow.
We've got one that's about...
You be the judge. Which one is fantastic and will kill everybody?
Okay, they're all good.
All right, man.
Okay, thanks a lot, George.
Okay, man.
Take care. Bye-bye. And hi there, you're on the air. Okay, thanks a lot, George. Hi there, it's you.
Yeah, maybe the one that Ted Vito. Hello?
Hi there.
Oh, yeah, but you know, an old friend of mine, Reed Dragonette, a great poet, passed us or so. She knew Theodore Sturgeon and talked about him very reverently. And I haven't met him since I was a teenager, so I'm going to go with you, whichever you think the best is. But I think that his own voice might be interesting, especially if he can read well. Okay?
Yeah, he wasn't a brilliant reader, but it is his own voice, and that, I think, makes a difference.
Okay, well, I'm going to rely on you, man. Thanks.
Okay, thanks a lot. Take care. Okay, well, I think then that we got we got the most votes, I think, on a specific story for Saucer of Loneliness, but I'm not going to go there because A, I know that we've broadcast that within the last 2 years. B, we might do it again because it's a favorite story of mine, and that is a full radio drama. And yeah, I think I would like to hear Ted's voice. I think that that was the most compelling thing that I heard from the various listeners. And so we have a coin flip between a 20-minute reading and a 62-minute reading. And the problem with 62-minute reading is, it would be over. It is tempting, though, because Baby is Three is a wonderful story. But then again, so is the Hercule is a Happy Beast. You know what? I'm going to go with Hercule, just on the grounds that it will give us the elbow room and the ability to talk for a while afterward. And to talk more about Sturgeon and deal with... other things, and maybe I'll even then, heck, I could actually, if I squeezed them in, I could do both Saucer of Loneliness and the Hercule is a Happy Beast. Okay, let's start with the Hercule is a Happy Beast, and after that, we will see where it goes. I will tell you that this is from Alternate World Recordings, made in the mid to late 70s, and I got this copy through Daniel Dern, both a science fiction writer and also a technology writer. We are often in the same business, and he has worked for me, and I have written some minor things for him. Pardon, but he found these, and the funny thing is, I worked for this record company put out something like 5 records. There was one of Ellison, there was one of Robert E. Howard, that was their very first one, and there were two of Theodore Sturgeon. And I edited some of this material. I don't remember which. It was a long time ago. I mean, we're talking 35 years, gang. Okay. One way or the other, I believe Ted will introduce the story himself. This is WBAI in New York.
The Hercule is a happy beast, I have to tell you. Began as a very serious and important story. But it took the bit in its own teeth and ran away from me laughing. The Hercule is a happy beast. This all happened quite a long time ago. Lert is either in a different universal plane or in another island galaxy. Perhaps these terms mean the same thing. The fact remains that Lert is a planet with three moons, one of which is unknown, and a sun, which is as important in its universe as is ours. Lert is inhabited by Gwik, its dominant race, and by several less highly developed species, which, for purposes of this narrative, can be ignored, except, of course, for the Hercule. The Hercule are highly regarded by the Gwik as pets, in spite of the fact that a Hercule is so affectionate that it can have no loyalty. The prettiest of the Hercule are blue. Now, on Lert, in its greatest city, there was trouble, the nature of which doesn't matter to us, and a Gwik named Havav, whom you may immediately forget, blew up a building which was important for reasons we cannot understand. This event caused great excitement, and Gwik left their homes and factories and Struubles and streamed toward the center of town, which is how a certain laboratory door was left open. In times of such huge confusion, the little things go on. During the 10 days that shook the world, the cafes and theaters of Moscow and Petrograd remained open, people fell in love, sued each other, died, shed sweat and tears, and some of these were tears of laughter. So on Lert, while the decisions on the fate of the miserable Havav were being formulated, Gwik still fardled, funted, and fupped. The great central Houghton still beat out its mighty pulse, and in the Anams the Corsons grew. Into the above-mentioned laboratory, which had been left open through the circumstances described, wandered a Hercule kitten. It was very happy to find itself there, but then the Hercule is a happy beast. It prowled about fearlessly. It could become invisible if frightened, and it glowed at the legs of the tables and at the glittering racked walls. It moved sinuously, humping its back and arching along the floor. Its front and rear legs were as stiff and straight as the legs of a chair. The middle pair had two sets of knees, one bending forward, one back. It was engineered as ingeniously as a scorpion, and it was exceedingly blue. Occupying almost a quarter of the laboratory was a huge and intricate machine, unhoused, showing the signs of development projects the galaxies over. Temporary hookups from one component to another, cables terminating in spring clips, measuring devices standing about on small tables near the main work. The kitten regarded the machine with curiosity and friendly intent, sending a wave of radiations outward, which were its glow, or purr. It arched daintily around to the other side, stepping delicately but firmly on a floor switch. Immediately there was a rushing, humming sound, like small birds chasing large mosquitoes, and parts of the machine began to get warm. The kitten watched curiously and saw, high up inside the clutter of coils and wires, the most entrancing muzziness it had ever seen. It was like heat flicker over a fallow field. It was like a smoke vortex. It was like red neon lights on a wet pavement. To the Hercule kitten's senses, that red-orange flicker was also like the smell of catnip to a cat or anise to a terrestrial terrier. It reared up toward the glow, hooked its forelegs over a bus bar, fortunately there was no ground potential, and drew itself upward. It climbed from transformer to power pack, skittered up a variable capacitor, the setting of which was changed thereby, disappeared momentarily as it felt the bite of a hot tube, and finally teetered on the edge of the glow. The glow hovered in midair in a sort of cabinet, which was surrounded by heavy coils embodying tens of thousands of turns of small wire and great loops of bus. One side, the front of the cabinet, was open, and the kitten hung there fascinated, rocking back and forth to the rhythm of some unheard music it made to contrast this sourceless flame. Back and forth it rocked and wove, riding a wave of delicious, compelling sensation. And once, just once, it moved its center of gravity too far from its point of support. Too far? Far enough. It tumbled into the cabinet, into the flame. One muggy mid-June day, a teacher, whose name was Stott, and whose duties were to teach 7 subjects to 40 Moppets in a very small town, was writing on a blackboard. He was writing the word Madagascar, and the air was so sticky and warm that he could feel his undershirt pasting and unpasting itself on his shoulder blade with each round A he wrote. Behind him, there was a sudden rustle from the moist seventh graders. His schooled reflexes kept him from turning from the board until he had finished what he was doing, by which time the room was in a young uproar. Stott about-faced, opened his mouth, closed it again. A thing like this would require more than a routine reprimand. His 40-odd charges were writhing and squirming in an extraordinary fashion, and the sound they made, a sort of whimpering giggle, was unique. He looked at one pupil after another. Here a hand was busily scratching a nape. There a boy was digging guiltily under his shirt. Yonder a scrubbed and shining damsel violently worried her scalp. Knowing the value of individual attack, Stott intoned, "Hubert, what seems to be the trouble?" The room immediately quieted, though diminished scrabblings continued. "Nothing, Mr. Stott," quavered Hubert. Stott flicked his gaze from side to side. Wherever it rested, the scratching stopped and was replaced by agonized control. In its wake was rubbing and twitching. Stott glared and idly thumbed a lower left rib. Someone snickered. Before he could identify the source, Stott was suddenly aware of an intense itching. He checked the impulse to go after it, knotted his jaw, and swore to himself that he wouldn't scratch as long as he was out there front and center. "The class will," he began tautly, and then stopped. There was a something on the sill of an open window. He blinked and looked again. It was a translucent bluish cloud, which was almost nothing at all. It was less than a something should be, but it was indeed more than a nothing. If he stretched his imagination just a little, he might make out the outlines of an arched creature with too many legs. But of course that was ridiculous. He looked away from it and scowled at his class. He had had 2 unfortunate experiences with stink bombs, and in the back of his mind was the thought of having seen once, in a trickstore window, a product called itching powder. Could this be it, this terrible itch? He knew better, however, than to accuse anyone yet. If he was wrong, there was no point in giving the little geniuses any extracurricular notions. He tried again. He swallowed. This itch was... The class will... He noticed that one head, then another, and another was turning toward the window. He realized that if the class got too interested in what he thought he saw on the windowsill, he'd have a panic on his hands. He fumbled for his ruler and rapped twice on the desk. His control was not what it should have been at the moment. He struck far too hard, and the reports were like gunshots. The class turned to him as one, and behind them, the thing in the windowsill appeared with great distinctness. It was blue, a truly beautiful blue. It had a small spherical head and an almost identical knob at the other end. There were 4 stiff, straight legs, a long, sinuous body, and 2 central limbs with a boneless look about them. On the side of the head were 4 pairs of eyes of graduated sizes. It teetered there for perhaps 10 seconds and then, without a sound, leapt through the window and was gone. Mr. Stott, pale and shaking, closed his eyes. His knees trembled and weakened, and a delicate, dewy mustache of perspiration appeared on his upper lip. He clutched at the desk and forced his eyes open, and then, flooding him with relief, pealing into his terror, swinging his control back to him, the bell rang to end the class and the school day. "Dismiss," he mumbled, and sat down. The class picked up and left, changing itself from a twittering pattern of rows to a rowdy kaleidoscope around the bottleneck doorway. Mr. Stott slumped down on his chair, noticing that the dreadful itch was gone, had been gone, since he had made that thunderclap with the ruler. Now, Mr. Stott was a man of method. Mr. Stott prided himself on his ability to teach his charges to use their powers of observation and all the machinery of logic at their command. Perhaps, then, he had more of both at his command, after he recovered himself, than could be expected of an ordinary man. He sat and stared at the open window, not seeing the sun-swept lawns outside. And after going over these events a 6 times, he fixed on 2 important facts. First, that the animal he had seen, or thought he had seen, had 6 legs. Second, that the animal was of such a nature as to make anyone who had not seen it believe he was out of his mind. These 2 thoughts had their corollaries. First, that every animal he had ever seen which had 6 legs was an insect. Second, that if anything was to be done about this fantastic creature, he had better do it by himself, and whatever action he took must be taken immediately. He imagined the windows being kept shut to keep the thing out in this heat, and he cowered away from the thought. He imagined the effect of such a monstrosity if it bounded into the midst of a classroom full of children in their early teens, and he recoiled. No, there could be no delay in this matter. He went to the window and examined the sill. Nothing. There was nothing to be seen outside either. He stood thoughtfully for a moment, pulling on his lower lip and thinking hard. Then he went downstairs to borrow 5 pounds of DDT powder from the janitor for an experiment. He got a wide, flat wooden box and an electric fan and set them up on a table he pushed close to the window. Then he sat down to wait, in case, just in case, the blue beast returned. When the Hercule kitten fell into the flame, it braced itself for a fall at least as far as the floor of the cabinet. Its shock was tremendous then, when it found itself so braced and already resting on a surface. It looked around, panting with fright, its invisibility reflex in full operation. The cabinet was gone. The flame was gone. The laboratory with its windows lit by the orange Lurtian sky, its ranks of shining equipment, its hulking complex machine, all were gone. The Hercule kitten sprawled in an open area, a sort of lawn. No colors were right. Everything seemed half-lit, filmy, out of focus. There were trees, but they were not low and flat and bushy like honest Lurtian trees. These had straight naked trunks and leaves like a portal's tooth. The different atmospheric gases had colors. Clouds of fading, changing, faint colors obscured and revealed everything. The kitten twitched its calfmers and ruddled its cump, right there where it stood, for no amount of early training could overcome a shock like this. It gathered itself together and tried to move, and then it got its second shock. Instead of arching over inchworm-wise, it floated into the air and came down 3 times as far as it had ever jumped in its life. It cowered on the dreamlike grass, darting glances all about, under and up. It was lonely and terrified and felt very much put upon. It saw its shadow through the shifting haze, and the sight terrified it even more, for it had no shadow when it was frightened on alert. Everything here was all backwards and wrong way up. It got more visible instead of less when it was frightened. Its legs didn't work right, it couldn't see properly, and there wasn't a single solitary malapec to be throttled anywhere. It thought some music. Happily, that sounded all right inside its round head, though somehow it didn't resonate as well as it had. It tried with extreme caution to move again. This time its trajectory was shorter and more controlled. It tried a small, grounded pace, and it was quite successful. Then it bobbed for a moment, seesawing on its flexing middle pair of legs, and with utter abandon flung itself skyward. It went up perhaps 15 feet, turning end over end, and landed with its stiff 4 feet in the turf. It was completely delighted with this sensation. It gathered itself together, griting with joy, and leapt up again. This time it made more distance than altitude, and bounced 2 long, happy bounces as it landed. Its fears were gone in the exploration of this delicious new freedom of motion. The Hercule, as has been said before, is a happy beast. It curvetted and sailed, soared and somersaulted, and at last brought up against a brick wall with its stunning and unpleasant results. It was learning, the hard way, a distinction between weight and mass. The effect was slight but painful. It drew back and stared forlornly at the bricks, just when it was beginning to feel friendly again. It looked upward and saw what appeared to be an opening in the wall some 8 feet above the ground. Overcome by a spirit of high adventure, it sprang upward and came to rest on a windowsill, a feat of which it was very proud. It crouched there, preening itself, and looked inside. It saw a most pleasing vista. More than 40 amusingly ugly animals, apparently imprisoned by the lower extremities in individual stalls, bowed and nodded and mumbled. At the far end of the room stood a taller, more slender monster with a naked head, naked compared with those of the trapped ones, which were covered with hair like a Mawson's egg. A few moments' study showed the kitten that in reality only one side of the heads was hairy. The tall one turned around and began making tracks in the end wall, and its head proved to be hairy on the other side, too. The Hercule kitten found this vastly entertaining. It began to radiate what was on alert, a purr or glow. In this fantastic place, it was not visible. Instead, the trapped animals began to respond with most curious writhings and squirmings and susurrant rubbings of their hides with their claws. This pleased the kitten even more, for it loved to be noticed, and it redoubled the glow. The receptive motions of the animals became almost frantic. Then the tall one turned around again. It made a curious sound or two. Then it picked up a stick from the platform before it and brought it down with a horrible crash. The sudden noise frightened the Hercule kitten half out of its wits. It went invisible, but its visibility system was reversed here, and it was suddenly outstandingly evident. It turned and leapt outside, and before it reached the ground, a loud metallic shrilling pursued it. There were gabblings and shufflings from the room, which added force to the kitten's consuming terror. It scrambled to a low growth of shrubbery and concealed itself among the leaves. Very soon, however, its irrepressible good nature returned. It lay relaxed, watching the slight movement of the stems and leaves. Some of them may have been flowers, in a slight breeze. A winged creature came humming and dancing about one of the blossoms. The kitten rested on one of its middle legs, shot the other out, and caught the creature in flight. The thing promptly jabbed the kitten's foot with a sharp black probe. This the kitten ignored. It ate the thing and belched. It lay still for a few moments, savoring the sensation of the bee in its clawful. The experiment was suddenly not a success. It ate the bee twice more and then gave it up as a bad job. It turned its attention again to the window, wondering what those racks of animals might be up to now. It seemed very quiet up there. Boldly the kitten came from hiding and launched itself at the window again. It was pleased with itself. It was getting quite proficient at precision leaps in this mad place. Preening itself, it balanced on the windowsill and looked inside. Surprisingly, all the smaller animals were gone. The larger one was huddled behind the shelf at the end of the room. The kitten and the animal watched each other for a long moment. The animal leaned down and stuck something into the wall. Immediately there was a mechanical humming sound, and something on a platform near the window began to revolve. The next thing the kitten knew, it was enveloped in a cloud of pungent dust. It choked and became as visible as it was frightened, which was very. For a long moment it was incapable of motion. Gradually, however, it became conscious of a poignant, painfully penetrating sensation which thrilled it to the core. It gave itself up to the feeling. Agonized ecstasy rolled over it, and it began to dance to the waves. It glowed brilliantly, though the emanation served only to make the animal in the room scratch hysterically. The Hercule felt strange, transported. It turned and leapt high into the air, out from the building. Mr. Stott stopped scratching. Disheveled indeed, he went to the window and watched the odd sight of the blue beast, quite invisible now, but coated with dust, so that it was like a bubble in a fog. It bounced across the lawn in huge floating leaps, leaving behind it diminishing patches of white powder in the grass. He smacked his hands, one on the other, and, smirking, withdrew to straighten up. He had saved the earth from battle, murder, and bloodshed forever. But he didn't know that. No one ever found out what he had done. So he lived a long and happy life. And the Hercule kitten? It bounded off through the long shadows and vanished into a copse of bushes. There it dug itself a shallow pit, working drowsily, more and more slowly. And at last it sank down and lay motionless, thinking strange thoughts, making strange music, and racked by strange sensations. Soon even its slightest movement ceased, and it stretched out stiffly, motionless, for about 2 weeks. At the end of that time, the Hercule, no longer a kitten, was possessed of a fine, healthy litter of just under 200 young. Perhaps it was the DDT, and perhaps it was the new variety of radiation that the Hercule received from the terrestrial sky, but they were all parthenogenetic females, even as you and I. And the humans? Oh, we bred so, and how happy we were. But the humans had the slidey itch, and the scratchy itch, and the prickly or tingly or titillative parasitic formication. And there wasn't a thing they could do about it. So they left. Isn't this a lovely place?
The Hercule is a happy beast, read for you by the author, Theodore Sturgeon, here over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. This is Catherine Tickell. You know, one of the advantages to choosing the shorter reading by Theodore Sturgeon is that you can have your cake and eat it too. Turn the Wayback Machine to 1957.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents...
X, 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 X.
minus one. Tonight, the time is June 25th, 1962. The place, a lonely beach. The story, Saucer of Loneliness by Theodore Sturgeon.
My name is Jason Bernayades. I'm a newspaper reporter, 31 years old. I write poetry, but I don't show it to anybody because they might laugh. And the things I write about are very important to me. I was an only child. I never went with girls much because I'm too ugly and too sensitive. And they used to hurt me. I live alone. It isn't much fun. I'm not painting this picture of myself to get sympathy. I don't need it. But it's important that you should know the kind of person I am. Otherwise, you won't understand what I'm going to tell you. It happened tonight, the thing I'm going to tell you about. Tonight. The 25th of June, 1962. I was down on the beach.
Hey! Mister! Hey, mister!
What is it, kid?
You seen a cop around any place?
On this beach?
I found this pile of clothes down near the rocks. A lady's dressing in shoes.
Well, did you see anybody? A girl?
Well, I think so, but she was running along the sand in the moonlight. I yelled to her, but she just kept running, and then I found these.
Look, kid, you go try to find a cop someplace. I'll see if I can find the girl.
Okay.
I thought to myself, she's dead. I'll never find her now in this white flood of moonlight with the surf seething in over the pale sand. I ran and ran until my knees buckled and went down in the swirl of it, the sea on my lips, with the taste of tears, and the whole white night shouted and wept. And then I saw her, waist deep, walking into the surf.
Stop! Stop it! Come back! Come on, come out!
Let go! Let me go!
Don't do it! Please don't!
Leave me alone! Leave me alone.
I'm going to have to hit you. Forgive me.
I hit her in the neck with the edge of my hand, and she slumped. I brought her ashore and carried her to where a dune was between us and the water. Then I rubbed her wrists. She had a pale, beautiful face with ancient, bottomless blue eyes. She opened them and looked at me after a moment. It's all right. Here, put my coat over you.
Why couldn't you leave me alone?
I couldn't.
Why?
Because it's important to me.
I suppose you'd want to know why I did it.
If I told you I understand, would you believe me?
How could you understand?
Maybe I know what it means to be lonely.
That.
That's it, isn't it?
I don't know. I'm so terribly tired.
Put your head against my arm and just stay.
I...
Don't be afraid. I've been looking for you for a long time.
Looking for me?
All my life.
How did you know? I don't believe you.
It's true. I found your message.
Oh?
So you see, there's nothing to be afraid of. Not anymore. Just rest. The moonlight is terribly white.
Yes. I'd like to rest for a while.
She didn't remember it, of course, but I was one of the reporters who had covered the story when it first happened, 5 years ago. I'll never forget that day. I was working the police blotter. It was a quiet summer afternoon when they brought her in. Two big cops in blue uniforms.
Come on now, girlie, come on.
Let me go. I haven't done anything.
Now take it easy now.
What's the trouble, Connolly?
Disturbing the peace, Sergeant.
Is this that Central Park call?
Hey, this is it.
I thought you radioed that there was a near riot up there.
Oh, you should have seen the place.
All right, give me the report.
Well, me and Bennett got up there, and there was a mob of people all surrounding this girl, see? So we bust through, and there in the middle of maybe 600 people, she's lying there, sort of in a faint. I asked a couple of people what the difficulty was, and they tell me it's the flying saucer.
The what?
The flying saucer.
What flying saucer?
Let me finish, Sergeant. What flying saucer, I ask. And then they says that this girl was standing on the green, and suddenly the saucer comes down and starts whirring over her head like a halo.
What is this, miss? A gag?
It happened.
It did, eh? Well, now suppose you tell me your version.
I was standing in the park, and I looked up, and there it was.
Describe it.
It was beautiful. It was golden with a dusty finish, like an unripe Concord grape. It made a faint sound, a chord of two tones. And it circled over my head like some great round hummingbird.
Go on.
Well, other people must have seen it because they were all looking at me and pointing. I saw one man cross himself. And then it came down and touched me and spoke to me.
This flying saucer spoke to you?
Yes.
And, just what did it say to you? I said, what did it say?
I can't tell you.
A secret, huh?
Yes.
I see. Connolly, this girl is for Bellevue.
Well, Sergeant, the plain fact is that it happened just like that. And 10 witnesses all agree it did.
Are you trying to tell me that there was such a thing as this whirring hummingbird of a saucer?
Oh, there was that, Sergeant.
And just how do you know, Connolly?
Well, we've got the thing out in the squad car.
You what?
Bennett's bringing it in right now, see? About 36 inches across it is. And covered with strange markings.
Great, Mother. Did you call the bomb squad?
I didn't think of it.
Well, think of it, man. This may be some kind of atomic weapon.
I'll turn it over to ballistics.
Never mind about ballistics. Call the FBI and tell them we've got this thing.
Yes, sir. What about the girl?
We'll book her on disturbing the peace. I've got a feeling the government men may want a word with her.
Sergeant.
What is it, Benitez?
I'd like to do a story on this for my paper. Could I have a look at the saucer?
We'd better clear it first.
Well, could I talk to the girl?
After she's been booked.
Connolly, is the crowd still up at the park?
Very likely.
Well, I'll run up there and get some eyewitnesses. Then I'd like to come back and talk to the girl.
Up at the park, they were still buzzing about it. Some said she was a communist agitator. Some said it was a flying saucer from Mars and she had stepped out of it. Others said she was a saint and it was her halo. I took some notes, phoned the paper, and went back downtown to talk to her. But there were a couple of agents with her and they wouldn't let me in.
Now then, miss, you told the sergeant this saucer spoke to you, is that correct?
Yes.
Did it speak to you in English?
I don't know.
You did understand it, though?
Yes.
Do you speak any other languages?
No.
Tell me, what message did you receive from this instrument?
Wasn't anything, really.
Suppose you tell me.
I'd rather not.
Miss, let me be very frank. I'm not a policeman. I'm a security agent. That means that I deal with problems that affect the security of our country. Do you understand?
Yes.
Now, we've examined this flying saucer enough to know that it is not of American manufacture. It also possesses an extremely high radioactive count. Now, that means that it was made in an area where radioactive materials are in great abundance, such as an area where atom bombs are made. That's why we want to know the message you received from the saucer.
There was no message.
You just made it up?
Yes.
I'm afraid you're lying. Suppose we have some soldiers bring the saucer in here and hold it over your head. Would you object?
I don't care what you do.
All right, boys, bring it in. Now, when I tell the men to hold it over your head, you try to recall what it said.
I don't know what it said.
Lift it up, boys. Hold it right over her head.
All right.
It's talking to you now, isn't it?
Yes.
What is it saying? What did it say? All right, boys, crate it up and send it down to the National Research Laboratories.
What about the girl, sir?
We'll get nothing out of her. I don't believe she really knows what that humming noise is. Better have a psychiatrist examine her.
Yes, sir.
They took her to the city hospital, and she had a room to herself. Whenever the door opened, she could see the policeman outside. The door opened quite often. There were a lot of important people, some in army uniforms, who came up from Washington just to see her and talk to her. Apparently, they had analyzed the flying saucer and discovered something that made this girl about the most important person in the country. I used to stand outside, and I could identify the heads of certain security agencies, but nobody would answer the questions that the reporters shot at them.
Sir, excuse me?
Yes?
I'm Jason Benayades from the Trib. I've been assigned to this flying saucer story as chief of the security...
I'm sorry, I have no comment.
Can you tell me how long the girl will be held?
That's a matter for the civil authorities.
We'll have the psychiatrist...
Excuse me, Mr. Benayades. My car's waiting.
A few days later, she was released from the hospital and returned to the court to be tried on the disorderly conduct charge. They found her guilty and fined her $15 and turned her loose. When she walked out of the courtroom, she was handed a subpoena to appear before a congressional committee in private session. She answered all their questions except one. My paper sent me over to cover the hearings.
Now, young lady, I want to remind you that I'm a senator of the United States and empowered by the people of this country to ask questions relating to matters of security. You understand?
Yes.
Your name is Janet Boyce, is it not?
I told you that.
Now, at an earlier session, you testified that as a young girl, you were a member of a certain organization in your neighborhood. Would you name it?
The Rinky Dinks.
Who comprised the Rinky Dinks, Miss Boyce?
It was just a bunch of girls who got together to play field hockey and listen to recordings.
Any particular recordings?
Mostly Eddie Fisher.
I see. Now, this flying saucer, you said it talked to you. You did say that, didn't you?
Yes.
And then you denied it?
Yes.
Why?
Because I was tired of answering questions.
Young woman, let me put something to you squarely. Oh, by the way, I think if there are members of the press here, I can divulge a rather spectacular piece of information to you. This flying saucer has been thoroughly examined and analyzed, and I wish to inform the people of this great nation that it definitely, I repeat, it definitely did not originate on this planet. Now then, Miss Boyce, consider that it is possible that our Earth might be attacked from outer space by beings much stronger and cleverer than we are. And consider that perhaps you have the key to our defense against those beings. Don't you owe it to the world?
I don't think I owe anything to anybody.
Even if the Earth was not attacked, just think what an advantage it would give this country over its enemies. Young woman, I ask you, what did that flying saucer say to you? Do you know that what you're doing is tantamount to working for the enemies of your country? I will give you one more chance. What was the message?
It was personal.
Gentlemen, I move that Miss Janet Boyce be cited for contempt.
The furor was fantastic. The chief of security blasted the senator for divulging secret information about the origin of the flying saucer, and the senator said the people had a right to know, and besides, he was just guessing anyway, and happened to guess right. Meanwhile, the press printed the girl's picture all over the front page and ran banner headlines such as, "Girl refuses to betray Martian secrets. Flying saucer girl won't talk, cited for contempt." The contempt trial was equally spectacular. She didn't plead any amendment or anything. She just said the saucer was talking to her, and it was nobody else's business. She was convicted and sentenced to 5 years in prison.
Benayades. Yes, Chief. For the Sunday supplement? What? Well, do you think there's anything in it? Okay, whatever you say. Mike, get me everything you can on that flying saucer girl, will you? Yeah, the one that was sent to jail about 4 years ago. See if you can find out what she's doing now. She was released about 6 months ago, I think. Uh-huh. Yeah, the boss wants a feature for the Sunday supplement. Okay. I found out she had gotten a job cleaning at night in offices and stores down near the beachfront. There weren't many to clean, but that meant there weren't many people to remember her face from the newspapers. I tracked her down and caught up with her in a one-arm coffee joint about 4 a.m. Excuse me, miss. Do you mind if I sit here?
No.
Nice night, isn't it? Moonlight and everything.
Which are you? Security, newspapers, or just somebody out for a good time?
You're pretty bitter, aren't you?
Shouldn't I be?
Yeah, I guess you should. My name is Jason Bernayades. I'm with the newspaper.
It's been nice meeting you. I have to go now.
Just a minute.
Please.
I can't blame you.
How did you find me?
One of the leg men located your mother. I talked to her earlier tonight.
Oh. How is she?
It's still hitting the bottle. The way she knew where you were, you sent her some flowers on her birthday, remember?
Yes. She wouldn't talk to me. Said she didn't want a daughter who was a jailbird.
Tell me how it's been.
So you can write about it?
I promise you I won't write anything you don't want me to write.
Okay. You want to know how it's been? Right after I got out of jail, I met a man at a restaurant. Nice man. He asked me for a date. I spent every cent I had on a red handbag to go with my red shoes. They weren't the same shade, but anyway, they were both red. And I was very excited about the date. We went to a movie. Afterward, he didn't even try to kiss me or anything. He just wanted to know what the flying saucer had told me. Didn't say anything. I just went home and cried all night.
And that was it?
No. I had another date. I get pretty lonely. This time they arrested the man I was with. He was a Russian agent. On Christmas Eve, four men called me up and sang me a song. Would you like to hear the words?
No, it doesn't matter.
They go, the flying saucer came down one day and taught her a brand new way to play. And what it was, she will not say. But she takes me out of this world.
I'm sorry.
Now will you go away and leave me alone?
Yes.
You're going to ask me the big question?
No.
Everybody does.
No, well, not me.
You will, sooner or later.
Maybe. Look, can I take you home?
No.
Can I see you again?
Please. I don't know. I'm afraid to let myself like anyone.
Trust me, will you?
I'm not sure.
Maybe.
Maybe.
I'll wait here for you tomorrow night.
All right.
The next night, I went back to the coffee joint to wait for her. I knew she got through about 4 a.m. I got there about 15 minutes early.
Mr. Bernayades?
Yes. Say, you're the chief of the security section, aren't you?
You have a good memory. Do you mind if I sit down?
Well, I'm expecting someone.
Yes, I know.
Oh, I see.
I'd like to talk to you.
Go ahead.
You probably know that we've been trying to gain the confidence of this girl for some years now.
Yes.
And apparently you've succeeded where we've failed.
Right? Not really.
In any event, you seem to be making some progress.
She may not even show up.
I think she will. Now, I'm going to ask you to help us.
Help? In what way can I help?
We have reason to believe that this girl is a courier for some alien power.
On what do you base that?
Well, there was the incident of the saucer, of course. We've definitely established that it came from some other planet. And recently, she's been throwing messages inside bottles into the ocean.
What sort of messages?
They're always the same. Now, I have one right here. You're welcome to read it and see if it makes any sense. We've had every decoding expert in the service trying to break it. But we can't seem to find the key.
I see.
Now, she's thrown literally hundreds of these messages in bottles into the sea. We've got many of them, but not all, naturally. Now, what we're most interested in is locating the contact.
Naturally.
And that's where you fit in. We'd like you to gain this girl's confidence even further. Try to find out just what these messages mean, and beyond that, what the saucer said to her. You'll be doing us a favor and your country a great service.
You're certain this is some subversive activity on her part.
How else can you explain the fact that she won't tell us her secret?
Maybe because it's hers, and everybody has a right to have something of his own.
Are you, trying to tell me that you won't cooperate?
I didn't say that.
I'd like to remind you, Mr. Benaides, that you have a duty to us.
I know that. I also have a duty to myself and to God. If you'll excuse me. I folded the bottle message and put it in my pocket. I waited for her to show up. The minutes went by, and the hours, and I knew she wasn't coming. Oh, she had come and seen me with the chief and changed her mind. That's when I left the cafe and walked down to the beach. That's when I dragged her out of the surf before she could follow one of her bottles into the water. How do you feel now? Are you cold?
Why should you care?
I do.
Is that why you were sitting with the security chief in the cafe?
I didn't arrange that meeting. He asked me to spy on you.
I suppose he told you about the bottles.
Yes.
Wonder how much of the taxpayers' money they spent gathering them up. I think they'd get tired of it. All the writing in the bottles is the same.
Maybe you could have saved a lot of trouble.
Do you think so? All of them. Judges, jailers, jukeboxes. People. Do you really think it would have saved me a minute's trouble if I told them the whole truth at the very beginning?
Wouldn't it?
No. They wouldn't have believed me. What they wanted was a new weapon. Some super scientific... super science from some alien super race. Science. That's all they think of.
Yeah, it's pretty important.
Would it ever have occurred to them that this super race from another planet might have super feelings? Or super longings? Super loneliness? No. All they think about is weapons. Isn't it time you asked me what the saucer said?
No.
They all asked me.
I don't have to ask you. I know.
You know?
Let me read it to you. There is in certain living souls a quality of loneliness unspeakable. So great it must be shared as company is shared by lesser beings. Such a loneliness is mine. So know by this that in immensity there is one lonelier than you.
How did you know?
It's the message you put in the bottles. The same message that
Some lonely, strange being in some other world put into a bottle, only his bottle was a flying saucer and sent across space to you.
You knew.
I'm lonely too. Look at me. I've never had the love of a woman. They think I'm pretty ugly.
You're not ugly.
No. I don't feel ugly right now.
Say it again. The message from the saucer.
Know by this that in immensity there is one lonelier than you.
I wonder if whoever first wrote it has found someone.
I think perhaps he has. She looked at me and said nothing. But it was as if a light came from her. More light than even the practiced moon could cast. Among the many things it meant was the fact that even to loneliness there is an end for those who are lonely enough, long enough.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features I Am a Nucleus by Stephen Barr, the story of a man who felt he was hexed because his comfortably untidy world had suddenly turned into a monstrosity of order. Galaxy Magazine, on your newsstand today. Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought to you Saucer of Loneliness, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by Theodore Sturgeon and adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in the cast were Elaine Rost as Janet, Nat Polan as Jason, William Keane as the sergeant, Jock McGregor as the cop, Mandel Kramer as the chief, and Wendell Holmes as the senator. This is Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Fred Way and is an NBC Radio Network production.
And this is WBAI in New York City, listener sponsor. There we go. Now I have to get them NBC chimes in. Listener sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. And that was, of course, A Saucer of Loneliness. They said Saucer of Loneliness. No. A Saucer of Loneliness. That's the title of the story. That was a 1957 production. It's been done a few times. There was a Twilight Zone in the mid-80s. Barrett Searles here of WBAI did a reading, not a dramatic reading. No, I take it back. It was a dramatic reading in the late 60s when Ted Sturgeon was hanging around here. He did a few. He did his own reading of A Touch of Strange, which is similarly a very strange, very romantic, beautiful style story. They also did one that is not often remembered, The Skills of Xanadu. Now Theodore Sturgeon wrote so many great, great short stories. And novels, More Than Human, Some of Your Blood, a number of great novels. He's one of those people you can't say what is the best short story. Maybe what is your favorite, and even then, that has to change all the time. But A Saucer of Loneliness may very well be the most adapted. Surprisingly, I really can't think of, there are no movies that I can think of that are based on Sturgeon. Certainly, there were two episodes of Star Trek, not based on, that he wrote. He was very important to the original Star Trek universe with one of their first comedy episodes, that was Shore Leave, and then Amok Time, which was the one where Spock must find a mate or die and is willing to kill Kirk in order to do it. And that is the one, as I mentioned earlier, that created the phrase live long and prosper. I mean, these are parts of the American culture that people are not even aware necessarily that Theodore Sturgeon gave them. He was, for those who listen to Max Schmid and the wonderful Gene Shepherd broadcasts that Max does, it was Theodore Sturgeon who wrote the book that Gene Shepherd turned into a bestseller before it was written. The famous book I, Libertine, where Shepherd, well, it's a whole long story. It's this wonderful thing about the day people versus the night people and how the night people were going to pull a joke on the day people and, you know, made up this novel called I, Libertine. And then Shepherd got Sturgeon to write it under the name R. Frederick Ewing, as I recall. And Sturgeon wrote the book. It was published by Ballantine Press. At the time, they were exclusively a science fiction publisher. But this was their one non-science fiction book. Frank Kelly Freeze did a classic cover for it. And very bizarre, very funny thing, you know, written by Sturgeon almost overnight. Instant bestseller because Gene Shepherd turned it into a bestseller before it was written. As I said earlier, Sturgeon touched pretty much everybody in so many ways. He's a champion of the short story, a champion of the literature. He turned science fiction into the modern, the middle age, or the first, no, let me try that differently. He took it out of its adolescence. It comes into its childhood with, it's invented, of course, more or less, in the 19th century by such writers as Mary Shelley. It is turned into a literature in the early 20th century in Amazing Stories and is just this literature of ideas and premises. But it was under John W. Campbell that Theodore Sturgeon begins to flourish and begins to put in characters. He begins to put in people, ideas. I mean, you heard that story, I hope, and you understand that this was about people. No, it's well written enough that you cannot remove the science fiction from it and still have the story in there. It wasn't a rewritten Western or anything like that. It was, however, just a beautifully composed story about people. And that 1951 story, it's 1951 that where he also wrote this story, The World Well Lost, which may be one of the very first stories of gay rights that today would hold up as being beautiful and eye-opening. Or not gay rights, but gay issues and rights inherent with that. But that story was published 60 years ago. So, when Ted Sturgeon died in, let me look it up. I've got a page here, as I recall. It was the mid-90s. Oh, wait. Okay, no, I'm on the wrong page. I'm on the page for A Saucer of Loneliness. Let me see. No, mid-80s, 1985. Been doing the show a while. I did not one, but four shows in a row to commemorate the work he had done, and tonight was another. And the reason for that being, that this coming Tuesday at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, Noelle Sturgeon, Ted Sturgeon's daughter, will be presenting an evening of readings and some discussion about Theodore Sturgeon. And that will be at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, 138 Sullivan Street. Admission is free. And I hope you will be there. And we will have two great, great science fiction writers to read Sturgeon's stories to you. And until I can already confirm N.K. Jemisin, and I can rumor that somebody, a former WBAI staffer, who's one of the world's greatest science fiction writers, so that limits it, may very well be the other reader, okay? So if you want to know more, if you want to join the mailing list, I'm Jim at OurWolf.com, OurWolf.com. And you can ask to be on the mailing list for the reading series. You just say the mailing list. I only have the one, you know, so you won't be getting onto a different one instead. So there we go. Okay, I have no time for calls. I will be back next week, Wednesday night, Thursday morning, from, I believe it's 1 to 3 o'clock. We're in fawn time. We're in begging time. But I plan to have a special and thoughtful program for you. A little more prepared than this morning, but I hope of no less quality. You can't get better than playing the Sturgeon. I'll tell you that. So, tune in then. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers. Lister is here, sorting out those CDs. And, well, again, send me an email, and we'll tell you all about the reading and future readings. Oh, yeah, next month, by the way, Michael Swanwick. I mean, we've got good stuff coming up. Thank you for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Enjoy yourselves.
Sails of silver. station. I'd assist him.
Burn it.
Revolutionary War is a necessary road to real liberation. Could we really win?
That I've known Lister, I've only wanted one thing, that someday he would produce a reggae version of If I Only Had a Brain, and I know he will. I'm Randy Cohen, I write the Ethicist column for the New York Times Magazine, and you can listen to Lister on WUSB 90.1 FM in Stony Brook, and Pacifica Radio WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.
the steeper the road you go.
Night. Night, night. This is your place to be. Night, night. prefer your wine or grind? She shake it up right on time. She shake it up right on time. Shake up long, shake.